So I'd like to welcome everyone to the session on defense and technology consulting. I'm Brock Schweitzer. I'm a postdoc in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology. And for this session, we're joined by two speakers who are going to talk about defense consulting and forensics. So at the very end, we're going to have about a 10-minute question and answer session. So if you could hold your questions till then, we'll get through the speakers. So first, I'd like to introduce Dr. Larry Kerr. Dr. Kerr is the Director for Countering Biological Threats within the Office of the Director of the National Intelligence. He previously served as a senior bioadvisor to the Director of National Counterproliferation Center, which is within the ODNI. He has served as a Director for Biodefense Policy in the White House Homeland Security Council, Assistant Director for Homeland Security in the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and as the Director for Bioterrorism Research and Development for the Office of Homeland Security. So before his work in the executive branch, Dr. Kerr has also worked in the Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH, and he was also an assistant professor here at Vanderbilt in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology. He holds a BS in biology and art history from Sewanee, that's here in Tennessee, and Dr. Kerr completed his PhD in cell biology from here at Vanderbilt and did his postdoctoral training at the Salk Institute in San Diego. So please welcome me, Dr. Kerr.
Good morning, everyone. It is indeed an honor and a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity. Let me just take this chance to express what is going to be the major theme of my talk today, and that is how we desperately, desperately seek your help and need your expertise within the government. And so you're going to hear me describe a lot of the activities that relate more to my experience in science policy and how your attributes and the knowledge that you've gained here could be of use throughout the government. So I am going to go very strictly by the questions that we were asked, and you will have these slides, so I'm going to kind of breeze through them so that you have some time for questions. But we were asked to describe, so what do I do now? So as Brock said, I'm the Deputy Director for Global Biological Threats, and my direct boss is the Director of National Intelligence. My primary customer is the President of the United States and the National Security Council. What that means is that me and my team of PhD biologists are asked to think about the way in which we organize the 16 departments and agencies of the intelligence community and the way in which they go about doing their job. Now, you talk about global biological threats, so you have to think about the entire continuum that that represents, everything from infectious diseases that can represent a material threat to the United States, our allies, or its interests, all the way through bioterrorism and biological warfare. We have to think not only about the actors, whether those be individuals, terrorist groups, or nation states, but whether or not those entities have the capability to actually pull off a biological weapons attack. So with our primary customer being the President and the National Security Council, you can imagine that what we're doing in terms of working with the intelligence community agencies is looking at the coordination of those entities, looking at and setting the strategy for where we want the capabilities of the IC to be in the next few years, setting the implementation plans in place for how they get there, and then advocating for the resources, both in terms of budget and personnel, in order to make that happen. That sounds really easy in a one-sentence statement, but there's a lot that goes into that, and I'll explain a little bit more about it as I go along. Many people don't really know what the IC does, and to put it very bluntly, our job is to steal secrets. And in stealing those secrets, we have to make sure that the people from which we steal them do not know about it, and that those sources and materials by which we steal those secrets are never known. When we report to the policymakers, we do not offer recommendations. We are forbidden from offering advice or recommendations. We offer judgments. and we offer material facts based upon the intelligence to policymakers to allow them to decide what to do with that information. I was asked to describe a typical day. I would not say that my day is exactly typical, so please don't take this for gospel truth for across the board. Temporally, my days run between 10 and 12 hours, 5 to 6 days a week. When I was in the White House, it was definitely a little bit more. You worked on more like 14 hours, usually 6 to 7 days a week. Because of the interactions now with downtown, majority of my days are actually spent down there, and 30 to 40% of my time is spent in travel, being either domestic or international in focus. So how did I get here? I was trying to find an easy way to express this. It is not exactly what one would call a straightforward path, and I'll try to explain the transitions. So I graduated in 1990 from Dr. Lynn Matrizian's lab in the Department of Cell Biology at Vanderbilt, and I went out to the Salk Institute for Cell Biology studying molecular virology and immunology. And it was a rough life, let me tell you. You have your own beach volleyball court right outside your laboratories, and you're looking out on Torrey Pines Golf Course, and you wear shorts probably 11 months out of the year. But you actually also really work hard. And so a combination of that working hard and, quite frankly, a lot of luck allowed me to progress from the postdoc to my faculty position here at Vanderbilt, where I was in the departments of microbiology and immunology and cell biology. And there acquired a phenomenal lab of graduate students, postdocs, research assistants, and we were working on the transcriptional regulation of gene expression in developmental biology. It was offered the distinct opportunity to work as a Robert Wood Johnson Fellow in 1998, and so went to the health subunit of the Senate Judiciary Committee, where I worked for Senator Orrin Hatch on the Hill. And it was really that opportunity where that was my first experience with the policy world. And what an experience it was. If you can imagine one PhD plunked down into the middle of 66 lawyers, you are handed everything from my first portfolio was dealing with the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act of 1957. Hell is that? I knew nothing about the Four Corner States. I had to learn about the Manhattan Project and the testing that the United States did with the atom bomb that accidentally contaminated many, many individuals that have since come down with many nasty cancers. And so the United States had to repay these individuals for the damage that they've occurred, and so was working on this as part of the legislative package that the Congress ultimately passed and President Clinton signed. But you have this portfolio that I usually describe as a standard portfolio of 4 or 5 issues that you're working, and then basically you wake up and turn on CNN or Fox to find out what you're going to be working on that day, because it can change that quickly. It's very emergency room-like. You have to understand the difference between authorization bills and appropriating bills. In other words, what gives the power versus what gives the money. And learning to work those systems is actually incredibly fascinating. And this is where your scientific expertise can be incredibly valuable, because there just aren't that many scientists on the Hill. And yet virtually any topic that you can think of involves science and technology in some aspect. It was actually during this time period that I caught what's called Potomac fever. And to put it bluntly, the lure of the policy world was so great that I undertook the transition from Vanderbilt, and I was fortunate enough to have an absolutely phenomenal research fellow, Fiona Yull, to be able to take over my laboratory and continue running, and she's a faculty here at Vanderbilt today. So I was finishing up my 2 years on the Hill when I was offered the opportunity to work at the National Institutes of Health. And I became Chief of Transplantation Immunobiology for Dr. Tony Fauci at NIAID, and was there exactly 9 months when President Bush asked Dr. Fauci if he had anybody who wanted to do policy. And so I was sent downtown to the Office of Science and Technology Policy, where I can, in retrospect, facetiously say I was working on some rather boring topics like stem cells and cloning, when there happened to be a little event on the morning of September 11th, when I was already at work and Secret Service came, kicked in the door and screamed, "Get out, it's a bomb." Fortunately, I grabbed my keys, we headed out West Executive Boulevard, and the gates were closed for the next 3 days. And that changed lives of hundreds, thousands, millions of individuals permanently, as it did mine. And for the next month, we were assigned within the office the responsibility by the Vice President to bring every technology that we could to bear on counterterrorism. We were working on that project when, on October 11th, 2001, we also found out of the death of an individual by inhalation anthrax. And I was the sole biologist in the White House at the time, and I can tell you again, that changed everything for my future, certainly. And so it was after that that I was transferred to the Homeland Security Council, at that time the Office of Homeland Security, and worked on a variety of projects relating to building the biodefense infrastructure of the U.S. to include our biodefense and national strategy for the 21st century for biodefense. I was there for a little over 5 years when my final assignment within the White House was working for Fran Townsend to draft the President's National Strategy for Avian and Pandemic Influenza, where at the time we were thinking that H5N1 was the potential threat at hand. Little did we know that 4 years later we would be looking at H1N1, and fortunately a mild virulent form of that. Shortly after that, I transitioned over to the current position that I described, and that's where I remain, and certainly can answer more questions about that if you have them. So some of these questions are fairly straightforward, and so the answer is, a postdoc required for my career? No, but. And this is where I'll show you something in the next few slides that will make a difference. And the reason that I add that caveat is because clearly, for example, the individuals now who are within my team, of which some of them are from Vanderbilt and microbiology. In fact, my deputy, Eric Prentice, graduated from microbiology and immunology in Mark Dennison's lab. And what you find is that you find everyone from individuals who have graduated with their PhD to people who have done postdocs to people who have been faculty come into the government, and all have a variety of ranges and roles and responsibilities commensurate with their training. So the question was asked, what types of companies, industries? I'd prefer to change that to federal, state, department, and agencies employ people like me. Easy. All 13 departments and agencies do. If there is not a single department that you can name that does not have an S&T component, an S&T advisor, an S&T department or division. And we actually found this out when we were going through the preparations for avian and pandemic influenza, because people don't generally think about Department of Commerce. What would they have need of a life scientist for? State Department. What does International Security and Nonproliferation, which has the largest cohort of PhD life scientists within the State Department, do? They do everything from our international S&T agreements to the international bioengagement programs to the cooperative threat reduction programs, dealing with how our country deals at the policy level and the implementation level with the interaction with other countries. And clearly within the intelligence community, again, not a single one of the individual 16 department and agencies is devoid of a life science expertise somewhere within that cadre. There are, of course, cadres, for example, at the CIA that are extremely large and hire individuals, again, ranging from recently graduates to individuals who have had postdoctoral training, to others that require a little bit more expertise in a given area. What do I like best and least about my job? I work with absolutely phenomenal people. There's sometimes a stereotype of individuals who work within the government as being lazy or being uninterested and dispassionate, bureaucratic. That is, I can tell you, absolutely not true. The central activities and personnel that kept me in the White House and keep me in my current job are those of just the incredible, passionate individuals, incredibly intelligent, constantly challenging. One of the aspects that you would find as scientists that I think it's actually hard to appreciate until you get out of an environment where you're surrounded with one another is that when you step into a group of people who are non-scientists, you immediately find that you think differently than others. You have developed skill sets or garnered your own skill sets where you learn how to ask a question, you find ways to answer that question, you continually evaluate whether or not you're answering the question correctly. That doesn't necessarily come when you're getting a degree in political science, economics, law, English. It's just a fundamentally different way of thinking, and that's the power that you bring from the discipline. Yes, there are the technical components that you have, but it's the skill sets that you've acquired that you need to find ways to articulate those skill sets to people who are looking to hire you. Least popular, probably the hours or in some cases the unnecessary bureaucracy. Yes, you have to find ways of doing things within the system. Yes, you have to find ways of doing things that are legal. And you have to understand how to maintain all of those boundaries and ask for help when you need it. The most challenging, maintaining focus and attention among distractions. And what I mean is you can imagine that there are an entire plethora of risks, threats, issues, i.e. the economy, that capture the attention of senior policymakers, and they have to focus on many different things at one time. Maintaining that devotion and dedication to your subject area can be a challenge, and it's something that you constantly have to struggle with. And the most rewarding, I think, is when you are faced with a truly difficult problem, and in our case, often of national proportion, and you're able to work with the departments and agencies and the White House to come up with a solution that ultimately benefits, in this case, our homeland and national security. So here's the slide that I was talking about of the difference in terms of where you may enter into the government. I don't know if you've already seen this morning, but this is easy to find all the information that I will be talking about with respect to your resumes, how you write them, what information is needed. The GS scales, the government service scales, are all found on the website of the Office of Personnel Management.gov that you see listed below. This is the scale for 2010, and what you see is on the left-hand side is the grade and then the steps as you increase across the top. A PhD just graduating from any of the life sciences coming into the intelligence community or the non-IC entities of the government can start anywhere between a 9 and 11. So you're looking at a salary range anywhere from 41,000 up through 65,000. Postdocs with, this would be a single postdoc. Additional postdocs do count towards your years of experience. Would start anywhere from 11 and go up through a 12. Faculty usually start easily at the GS-13 level. One of the things that I would strongly recommend, and I think this is on the next couple of slides, is I would encourage you that most of my students at Georgetown or in my master's biodefense class, one of the problems that I see whenever they say, Larry, how come I didn't get interviewed for this job? And they're showing me a vacancy announcement that is a GS-15. It's good to shoot high. Just be aware that the government has very defined definitions that you will find for each of these. And so fitting your skill sets into those requirements is critically important. And so if you overshoot, you simply get disqualified. And unfortunately, in some cases, I recently saw a job application. It was open for several positions within one department of the Health and Human Services. There were 10,400 applications for that job. And you have to understand that when there is someone, and I don't mean to be derogatory, but you may have someone in human resources that may be at like a 6 or a 7 who is simply going through and they're simply looking for keywords and highlighting. If those keywords are not in that resume or that application, it goes into the disqualified pile. And so the key is to make sure that your application and your resume is tied exactly to what the vacancy announcement is calling for, and that you highlight those skills and requirements under the necessary categories. So what opportunities are there for advancement? The government has what is called traditionally the revolving door, and it is a very powerful system whereby it often draws individuals in from the academic and private sector. They utilize their resources, they use their skills towards the benefit of whatever department or agency they're serving, and then they go back out in a few years to the academic or private sector to refresh their scientific or technical skills and then come back into the government. And so this can occur frequently throughout a person's career. We used to say that it was typical of the private sector in that you would see this about every 2 to 3 years. That actually isn't true now. You're seeing people stay more on the 4 to 5 year time frame. And then there is ultimately that decision of whether or not you wish to remain at the subject matter expert level, which is known as the professional cadre, versus do you wish to step into the supervisory category or the executive status. The important thing that I wish to emphasize is that if you decide to go into the senior executive service or the senior science and technology level positions, they do exist that you can continue to maintain your science and technical acumen throughout all stages of your career. So the answer is yes, you will be using your science skills all the way through. I didn't really know how to answer this question. I have to admit, I labored hard. My best advice would be follow your heart, and that's exactly what I did. So the best way for you to get a foot in the door, first, you can make the decision of whether or not you want to go directly and get a job. And if so, then you go to usajobs.gov, where all the vacancy announcements across the entire federal government are posted by law. They have to be opened. I don't know how to overemphasize this enough. This is something I didn't recognize when I left academia. The federal resume does not equal a CV. It does not equal an academic resume. It is critically important that the criteria that are requested in the federal resume you supply for response to a vacancy announcement. For example, and just one of them, I don't know that I ever have been asked in an academic resume that you put your beginning and your end salary. If you do not put that in your federal resume in your application, it is immediately disqualified. And so, you know, it is just an automatic DQ. So even just the subtleties of something like that, where you have the information, if you don't know to put it in there, it can disqualify you and you would never know about it. And so I strongly recommend looking at the very explicit website's instructions on the OPM website, and please proofread your resumes. I cannot tell you, having sat on multiple promotion committees, and it is not a good thing when you find multiple errors. The other opportunity that I strongly encourage are fellowships, such as the American Association for the Advancement of Science, that has a wide range of opportunities in global science and defense policies. There are also the individual associations. If you are in a particular field and you are interested in doing a fellowship in the legislative or executive branch, talk to whatever association you belong to, whether it be neurosciences, pharmacology, cell biology, American Society for Developmental Biology. Many of these, if they don't already have fellowship programs, they will sponsor you to go work on the Hill and the legislative branch, because it's in their best interest that science is being articulated to the federal policymakers. And so you can often work with them to say, hey, would you be willing to do blank, whether that's a year, whether it's a year plus a year. There are many opportunities. And finally, the consideration of the national security clearance. I always get this question, and the answer is I strongly recommend just everyone keep your noses clean and watch what you post on Facebook. Everybody asks me strange questions, I smoked pot once, does that disqualify me? The answer is no. There are no single disqualifying characteristics these days. If you continue to have activities such as that, there's a bit of a problem. For sake of time, I won't tell you a funny story, but there are some good ones that have come from that. 1 minute or time to go? Wrap up. Okay. How can you be attractive? Be one, while you are here, be the best scientist that you can possibly be. Because once you leave this environment, you will be in an environment where you will have to be continually educating yourself about the sciences. Never stop learning, but also, sounds somewhat contradictory, be more than a scientist. In other words, the five characteristics that you see up here upon which you are asked to define the characteristics that you have to get you into the government clearly encompass you as a person more than just as a scientist. I've talked about science policy, and within the intelligence community, there are the three major disciplines of analysis, collection, and bench scientist, where all life scientists can be utilized. Finally, the concept of what you are doing now versus what we think about in terms of national science policy, it's what I call gaining peripheral vision, where you go from focusing on a very defined subject to thinking about issues in a much grander scale. For example, now if you think about budgets in the order of 10,000 to 100,000, add 6 or 7 zeros, because clearly that's now what the responsibility you have when you're talking about 10 million to $100 million budgets. And finally, I will end with this, and that is, yes, we absolutely need any and all of you for your scientific skills and expertise, and I could not encourage you more. And if I can be of anything help, please do not be afraid to contact me afterwards. Thank you.